For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Thursday, April 20th, 2017. The NYPD body-worn camera program, which is slated to begin next week in New York City, is flawed. This is according to police reform advocates. David Rankin of Rankin & Taylor is attorney for Communities United for Police Reform.
This afternoon, our office filed a request to file an amicus brief with the federal court on behalf of Communities United for Police Reform, listing some of what we understand to be the deficiencies in the body camera proposal currently before Her Honor. Number one, the idea that you have police officers able to view what's on their body cameras before they start writing paperwork is exactly the wrong way to have body cameras implemented in our city. This really goes to like the heart of what body cameras are for. It's supposed to be a check on police officers' conduct, on police officers' reports, but if they know exactly what that check is, it completely defeats the purpose. The second main problem with the body camera proposal as written is there's no way to, the way that the access to that information is given is through the NYPD's FOIA office. The NYPD's FOIA office has been subject of much reporting in how completely backwards it is. The idea that these families are actually going to be able to get information from the FOIA office is really an illusion. There needs to be some type of streamlined system such that people can actually get this information. New York City is a first-class city. We have a monitor, we have a court order. We can do body cameras right, but this proposal certainly is not that.
Over 40 organizations have signed on to this legal filing. The main ask is to delay the implementation of the body-worn camera program. Darius Charney with the Center for Constitutional Rights was lead attorney in the stop and frisk case, Floyd versus City of New York. It resulted in court-mandated NYPD reforms. One is the body camera program. But as Charney tells us, the court-appointed federal NYPD monitor, Peter Zimroth, doesn't put the program up for court review.
The program that is supposed to launch next week was the program that was specifically ordered by the federal court in the Floyd versus City of New York stop and frisk lawsuit. So that is an important thing to remember here, because the reason we're here today, the reason we petitioned the court yesterday, and why Communities United for Police Reform petitioned the court today, is that the federal monitor in the stop and frisk litigation has taken the position that this body camera policy, which is supposed to govern the pilot that the court itself ordered, should not be subject to court review. So that's, you think about that for a second. The very court that ordered this pilot to take place, according to the monitor, should not have the ability to review that policy and make changes if that court feels that this policy is actually undermining the goals of this monitorship. And the goals of this monitorship are to reduce and eventually eliminate unconstitutional stop and frisk, racially biased stop and frisk practices of the NYPD that was proven to a federal court in 2013. So that is the first and foremost issue that we, as the plaintiffs in the Floyd case, are taking to the court, that this court clearly should have and does have the power to step in and review this policy and make sure that any problems with the policy are changed, because this pilot was ordered by the court.
Another major objection is a loophole in NYPD policy which doesn't require officers to turn cameras on in initial interactions with the public. These are called level one interactions, and they can easily escalate. Charney says the pilot program gives too much discretion for officers to avoid taping their policing activities.
As currently written and as approved by the federal monitor, the policy does not require what are called investigative encounters, all investigative encounters, to be recorded by the police. And investigative encounters, for those who don't understand what that term means in the police department, it includes stop and frisk. It includes the hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions of interactions that happen on the streets of New York every day, where the police are investigating crime, asking people accusatory questions, asking them to see ID, asking them where they live, asking them for their name, asking them for a lot of information that is not only invasive, but more often than not, will cause a situation to escalate to a much more adversarial, much more invasive encounter. And so at this point, if we were to go forward with this policy, we would not have there would be a whole plethora of encounters, of information that we would not have recorded on that camera, and that really defeats the purpose of this program.
Marquis Jenkins is community organizer with the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. He represents public housing residents, some who have been involved in situations where interactions with the NYPD quickly escalate.
We cannot stand behind a policy that not records the full interactions. Recording just level 2 and 3 interaction does not capture the whole picture. A policy must incorporate that the police officer's record started from the beginning. We argue that it further jeopardizes the police officer's safety if the police officer is told to record a situation in the middle of the incident. It takes the police officer's attention away from the incident. We recommend that the policy states that the recording starts at a level 1 encounter.
Those who are most typically going to be targeted by policies such as stop and frisk are going to be engaged in interactions with the police that, according to this policy, are not going to be required to be recorded.
Lori Daniel Favors is general counsel for the Center for Law and Social Justice at Medgar Evers College.
I want you to think about Romarley Graham. Think about Eric Gardner. And do we honestly believe that the police, as currently constituted, would have turned on cameras early enough for us to get enough context to understand what truly happened in those incidences? We need a policy that is going to mandate that the typical day-to-day encounters that quickly escalate from a stop to an arrest are going to be recorded, and that citizens who experience these encounters, New Yorkers who experience these encounters, are going to be able to get access to that footage so that they can ensure that they are able to receive justice.
We asked Darius Charney with the Center for Constitutional Rights to explain the differences between levels of police interaction with the public.
There was a New York Court of Appeals decision in the 70s called People versus DeBoer, D-E-B-O-U-R, which set out 4 different levels of basically police-civilian encounters, street encounters. 4 being the highest, most invasive, 1 being the lowest, kind of least intense. 4 is arrest, 3 is what we now call stop and frisk, 2 is kind of very murky. I frankly don't understand the difference between 2 and 3, but 2 is basically an encounter where it's called common law right of inquiry, but it's where you suspect the person you're questioning that maybe you suspect them of criminal activity, but you don't have enough evidence to actually forcibly detain them. In other words, you can question them and you know, ask them if they have drugs on them, ask to search them, but they are allowed to leave or refuse to answer your questions. And then level 1, which was actually the encounter that was at issue in the DeBoer case, is again, you're investigating some kind of criminal activity, and you go up to somebody and you just want to ask them, you're requesting information, not because you necessarily suspect them of the crime, but you think they may know something, so you go up and you ask them questions related to your investigation. The current policy would not require that last category of encounters, which are the most common, from being recorded. And the problem is, as the DeBoer case itself shows, you may start at level 1, but in a matter of seconds or minutes, you're at level 4. In DeBoer, they started at level 1, and within a couple minutes, they had searched Mr. DeBoer and arrested him for gun possession. But under this policy, the whole beginning of that encounter would not be recorded, so you really wouldn't know, was the officer justified or not justified in approaching and questioning this person? And that's a huge problem when you're talking about trying to enforce constitutional rights and constitutional policing.
Marquis Jenkins.
I'm glad you asked that, because residents, public housing residents, have that same question. What is the difference between a level 1, level 2, and a level 3 encounter? And what role does a police officer play at each of those levels? So if we are to use this as a pilot to arm residents with the information that they need to be able to protect themselves, then yes, we need to make sure that we are recording every level of encounter so that we can use that as a tool to inform and educate and empower public housing residents so that we improve not only the way policing is done, but that we strengthen the safety of public housing communities.
Lori Daniel Favors says it's too much to ask officers to decide when they should press record.
There's such a nebulous space in between what is appropriate for each level. So much of it is subjective and contextual that to be able to draw a fine line that that the legal minds that are behind a lot of this organizing aren't able to delineate clearly when that would begin and when that would end, I think that indicates that it's too much of a burden to place on police officers to expect that they would be able to make those determinations in the heat of the moment. And as a preventative measure that would really speak to that inability to make those quick snap decisions, it would be important to have a policy that says that all of those interactions should be monitored, especially under the auspices of a pilot program.
And there's another problem. That's the ability of the NYPD to review footage before they file a report on an interaction with the public. This goes against the very reason for the body-worn cameras. It's supposed to be a check on police activity. Daniels Favors.
We need to be clear that as it pertains to officers who are able to view footage before they submit a statement, would the NYPD allow the typical New York defendant to view footage that could possibly incriminate them prior to submitting a statement? I think they would resist that. And it is incumbent upon us who are intimately familiar with the ways in which the NYPD has practices that violate the rights of our community that we stand against those types of giveaways and safe harbors for wrong practices. It would be troubling and problematic to the extreme to allow reform measures such as body cameras to actually become tools that the police can use to further engage in harmful practices against our community.
Communities United for Police Reform want the NYPD body-worn camera program paused. This until NYPD policy is revised to address concerns of communities and plaintiffs. The brief filed requests that the court grant the CPR and communities directly affected a formal role in evaluating the NYPD pilot program, especially as to whether it should be canceled or expanded. And this is the news on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Turning to international news, French prosecutors opened a terrorism investigation into an attack on police officers on the Champs-Élysées Boulevard in Paris. The Paris prosecutor's office said counterterrorism investigators are involved in the probe into the attack today, which left a police officer and the attacker dead. Interior Minister spokesperson Pierre-Henri Brandet says the police officers killed the attacker. He said one police officer was killed and two others were seriously injured and hospitalized. Paris police spokesperson Johanna Primavera says an identified gunman appeared to be working alone when he allegedly opened fire on a police vehicle. Iran is failing to live up to the spirit of the nuclear deal struck in 2015, according to Donald Trump. He warned that his administration is debating whether or not to leave the landmark pact. Trump, in a news conference today with the visiting Italian premier, didn't telegraph whether he would ultimately decide to keep the U.S. in the deal or not, though he called it a terrible agreement that was poorly negotiated. His comments came the same week that his administration certified to Congress that Iran is complying, at least technically, with the terms of the deal. They are not living up to the spirit of the agreement, I can tell you that, Trump said. Turning to Venezuela.
Y con el 19 de abril, digamos, independencia y patria socialista. ¡Que viva la patria! ¡Hasta la victoria siempre! ¡Venceremos, venceremos, venceremos!
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro took to the streets on Wednesday in a massive rally to defend the leftist Bolivarian Revolution. It was launched by his late mentor, Hugo Chavez, in 1999. Maduro is fighting off the U.S., as well as the center-right opposition's effort to force him from power. This amid an economic crisis that has sparked severe food shortages, riots, and looting. Here's former Exxon CEO Donald Trump's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson speaking at the State Department.
Well, we are concerned that the government of Maduro is violating its own constitution and is not allowing the opposition to have their voices heard, nor allowing them to organize in a way that expresses the views of the Venezuelan people. Yes, we are concerned about that situation.
Tillerson says the U.S. is watching the situation closely and is working with others, particularly the Organization of American States, to communicate its concerns to Venezuela. Meanwhile, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says you are messing with the wrong country. Maduro says he is denouncing threats from the U.S. He says the U.S. government, the State Department, has given the green light for a shameless coup process to intervene in Venezuela. He said, "I am saying it as it is, and I will confront it." Meanwhile, New Yorkers with the Alberto Lavera Bolivian Circle say clear threats from D.C. on the overthrow of the Venezuelan government backed by extreme media distortion are beyond frightening. They rallied in Times Square alongside Black Lives Matter protesters in defense of the Maduro government in Venezuela. We sent out Ekeem Killick to gather their voices.
My name's Taryn Fivek, and I'm from New York City. Today we're out in the streets to commemorate 2 years since Freddie Gray was murdered in Baltimore, and also connect that to an anti-imperialist struggle abroad in Venezuela. White supremacy is a huge motivator for both police murder and also U.S. imperialism abroad. And so I feel like this kind of action shows the rest of the world that we're not going to stay quiet and just stand back and watch it happen. People need to overthrow capitalism as soon as possible and implement full socialism. I don't think it's the kind of thing that we can vote into office anymore, you know? I think it's the thing that we're going to have to get in the streets to be able to achieve.
My name is William Camacaro. I'm from Venezuela, originally from Venezuela. And we are in solidarity with Venezuela and working for the Bolivarian Circle Alberto Lavera, that is a group of people in solidarity with the Bolivarian Revolution. So we are here today basically because there is an attempt of coup against the Bolivarian Revolution today by the extreme right-wing, by different extreme right-wing groups supported by the State Department. And we are here with a group of people that are connected to the Black Lives Matter and that are fighting against police brutality. This is not a coincidence when you think that usually all the attack that United States, that the establishment of the United States realize against small countries all over the planet, most of the time are countries of people of color, countries that belong to the global south. And this is related to the history of this country that is a history of lynching. So basically, the culture of lynching has been is part of the foreign policy of this country.
What can be done for Venezuela today?
Well, first of all, we want people to understand that Venezuela doesn't have a humanitarian crisis, that doesn't have economic crisis, that Venezuela have economic warfare by United States and some of its allies. And that's the first thing that we have to mention. And then secondly, people have to be clear that Venezuela for the last 18 years has been attacked by the establishment of United States, by the State Department and the Pentagon. And people have to understand that. What people have to say and to do, what can do for Venezuela, is just denounce that establishment and the interfering, and denounce the interfering in the internal affair of Venezuela.
My name is Rosa Maria de la Torre. I'm Mexican from the stolen territory of Texas, and I'm retired. We are here, gathered here for two reasons today. One, because today there is the biggest celebration and rallying and marching in Venezuela. And we've gotten notices that there's over a million people in the streets in support of Maduro in the Bolivarian Revolution. And we're also here to remember and seek justice for all Black lives that have been taken away from us, all these young men and women that have been murdered by the state.
So I would like to ask, in that sense, what is the Bolivarian Revolution?
The Bolivarian Revolution is a socialist program that was also known as Chavista under Hugo Chavez, the late leader in Venezuela. They have done many great things for the people, the poor people. They have build schools and build hospitals and, you know, all the wonderful things that can happen in a planned society. However, that it was not an armed revolution. It was a revolution in the street, a revolution in the vote. And when that happens, there's still a lot of opposition inside the country. So right now, you know, all the rich people are against a system that's going to benefit the poor people. So there's a lot of opposition, but there's also a lot of people who are strong and standing solid with Maduro. We stand solid with Maduro. We know that they can win and they can stay and continue the work they have started. And they're under attack by this government, by the U.S., because they support the corporations that they go and steal from our countries in South America, and they want to take out all the benefits, but they don't want to give people, let people be independent and autonomous. They only want the leaders that bend to the rule of the U.S. And Maduro is not one of those. Maduro will continue to fight.
So my last question is that, how do these events related with us in NYC?
It links with us in a very personal way, because when Chavez was alive, he helped a lot of people in the U.S., and these are things that people, a lot of people don't know. But Chavez has given money to nonprofits, to young people in the South Bronx. The South Bronx is one of the two poorest congressional districts in the whole country. It's South Bronx and Webb County, and he has helped a lot of people. And also, they help with oil during the winter. They help us, because this government doesn't want to help us, especially now under Trump. They're shutting down all kinds of programs, and people like the Venezuelan government helps us, the poor people here.
I'm from Argentina. My name is Maria Canet. I'm an accountant. I work here. I live in New York. Like many like me that went out of their own country, we love to have democracy in Latin America. So we are really pursuing all the situations and all the causes that could be damaged for our liberties in Latin America. So we try to be together with our brothers and sisters from Latin America. So we believe in democracy, and we believe not in a formal democracy, not in the appearance of the democracy, but we want to pursue a real democracy for our countries.
So I would like to ask that, what are the current issues in Latin America today?
We had different presidents throughout Latin America, like Cristina Kirchner in Argentina, Néstor Kirchner, Lula in Brazil. We have still keeping in Bolivia Evo Morales. So we consider now is Moreno in Ecuador, the new president. We consider that the president of Latin America must really pursue a real democracy also. And that also, what happened is that there are many, many groups that are financial groups that are the one that try to defeat those presidents that are helping people.
I would like to ask that, how these events, how these current issues in Latin America, how they are related with the Bolivarian Revolution?
Well, there are many intellectuals. There are many people that really are interested to continue these changes in Latin America. And what they are trying is really to be connected And they don't want that Venezuela could be defeated. They don't want people get worse in Venezuela, because that will be really bad for the everyone else in Latin America. We have also problems in Mexico. We have problems in Peru. We have problems in Paraguay. So we really need to pursue to protect the governments that likes real democracy for us.
Members of the Alberto Levera Bolivian Circle in New York City with concern over threats by the U.S. in Venezuela. Thanks to WBAI's Akin Kilik for those listener voices. The Cuban foreign minister says Venezuela can solve its own problems. Bolivian President Morales says the attempt at intervention by the United States against Venezuela is to seize the oil. Meanwhile, the European Union is calling for an investigation into deaths and other violence during anti-government demonstrations last night in Venezuela, and for those responsible to be held accountable. 8 people have died so far in demonstrations over the past several weeks. The spokesperson for the United Nations, Secretary General Antonio Guterres, says the organization is concerned about what's happening in Venezuela and urges that all efforts be made to lower tensions and prevent further clashes. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, April 20th, 2017. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.